Rebel Space Confident Conversations, hosted by Kate Nash, OBE, with guest Emma Olivier, founder of 20% Disability Inclusion Advisory.
I first met Emma when she set up her company 20%, which is an advisory company which aims to help organisations to unleash the talent of the 20% of Australians who have a disability. When she came to the UK at the end of 2022, we were already planning our conversation together. Emma often starts her presentations with the opener, "Don't limit yourself by what others say," which has such meaning. She encourages her audiences to create their own view of how they want to be received as individuals. And in our conversation, you will hear her thoughts about how inner confidence relates often to our capacity to create and own our personal brands. She speaks powerfully about her life, about being born with one hand, and her school life in the 1980s, where we didn't really celebrate difference. We really celebrated being the same as everybody else. Emma credits the gift of disability as being a problem-solving skill, which she has used to carve an incredibly successful career. She started her career with Arthur Andersen and moved on to become a managing director for Accenture. There's a running theme throughout Emma's career and her job titles. She manages huge operations for massive organisations. Her journey in terms of navigating and managing difference, gaining a deep appreciation of what we need to do to navigate other people's stuff, including the use of humour to make both herself as well as others feel comfortable. I think you're going to be riveted and come away with some very practical ideas that you can try. I particularly loved her reminder that often the biggest limitations can be ourselves, you know, for all of the external barriers and policies and practices, etc., that might get in the way. Sometimes we too have to look inwards in order to look outwards. So these interviews are being brought to you with thanks to remarkable people who are choosing to share their learning about inner confidence in order that others can learn faster. Once you have listened, I'm going to ask one thing of you, and that is that you might send the link to five other individuals who might too be able to pass on the messages to five others. We're on a mission to cascade these messages. So Purple Space, we want to cascade a universal definition of inner confidence, which for us is a strong expectation of a positive outcome, and to share the practical things that we can do to create and navigate our working worlds while managing disability and all of the things that come with that. Enjoy this film. So I'm going to start our wonderful conversation with an open question, and that's really, why does this subject that we're about to explore together matter to the person who's just tuned in to this interview to listen and to watch? Why does this matter?
I think hearing stories of where other people have exercised confidence and resilience makes you reflect on how you've done it as well. And it makes you think about the times when it's worked and when it hasn't worked and what you would do differently. There's a thousand ways that we can demonstrate confidence and resilience. And I think it is like a muscle. The more we use it, the easier it gets. And I think the other part of it is that I believe it's a foundation of courage. Being confident and resilient gives us courage. And there are so many times in our life where we need courage to ask for help, to do something differently, to step outside our comfort zones. And so the more, you know, those three sort of elements of confidence, resilience, you know, underpinned by courage, they're great things, and they're things that we should talk about more often.
I love it. I've seen you do numerous presentations, and there's one that you start with, and you say, I'm just reading here, you start with the words, "Don't limit yourself by what others see." Tell me what you mean by that.
I think other, in my experience, other people can put limitations on you. They can not offer you things. They can make assumptions around what you can or can't do. They can offer you help in ways that may or may not be appropriate. And I think it's so important to, you know, you can do it in a kind, a considerate way, but to not be limited by how other people see you, but to create that view of how you want to be shown and project that out. So that's what I mean by how other people, don't limit yourself by how other people can see you.
I love it. Well, look, we're going to tuck into this conversation, which I've been looking forward to for a very long time. Last time we were together, we were eating dinner and breaking bread and having a glass of wine. And I know that through your story, there will be many learns, many shares that many people with different aspects of disability, different experiences are going to take away from this. So my next question is really to tuck into from where it all began, you know, your childhood, some reflections that you have growing up with disability, although you may not call it that. And I know our viewers and our listeners will be interested. So I'm keen to make this episode super, super accessible to anyone with any disability at any stage of their career. So whether they've shared that experience or not with the organisation that they work for, whether they have chronic illness, whether they have experienced disability from birth, or they might have had maybe a late diagnosis, perhaps of neurodivergence. So my first question is, when was the first time, I suppose, that you realised that you were a little bit different from the norm? And you may not use that language, but give us a kind of once upon a time, your story.
Well, I was born with one hand. So I think when you're born with something, in yourself, you feel the same as everyone else. So it probably wasn't till I went to school that I realised that perhaps I wasn't exactly the same as everyone else. And before school started, or in the first few weeks of school, someone from the Royal Children's Hospital came to speak to my class. And it's a very vivid memory. I don't remember the content, but it was weird having someone come from a hospital to come and speak to your class when you always have that desire to fit in. And then obviously through primary school, kids can be quite, I'm going to say, cruel sometimes. And I'm not sure what the international word for this, but in Australia we call them monkey bars, but play gyms, I suppose, in a schoolyard. I used to wear an artificial arm with a hook, and you'd play chasey. Kids would run away from you. If you were it, you had to find someone. Everyone went up on those monkey bars when I was it. And it is a very vivid memory of not being able to physically get to where everyone was. So it was probably things like that. On the flip side, I used to love saying to new teachers every year, it's hot in Australia when we start school, can I take my arm off on a hot day? Because I used to wear an artificial arm. It's like a plaster cast. And on a hot day, if it got to, you know, over 30 degrees, I'd want to put my hand up and take it off. And I always used to get quite entertained by the new teacher's reaction every year. So I've probably used humour to be comfortable and to perhaps make other people comfortable. But I definitely had that sense at school that I didn't look the same as everyone else.
Yeah. And how did that feel? How did it impact on you? And would you say it impacted on your confidence then as a child?
I think it actually made me more determined. I think it had a positive impact on my confidence because I wanted to have the same opportunities and succeed and fail the same as everyone else. So I always gave everything a go. Now, I wasn't always successful. And there were times that I wasn't able to do it because, again, other people said, you can't play netball, you've got one hand. I was very blessed to have a mother who was just as, I think, resilient as me, who probably gave me an example of resilience, who fought some of those early battles and said, no, 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 Emma should have the same opportunities as everyone else. Now, this was in the 70s. You know, the 70s and probably the 80s, it was all about assimilation. We didn't celebrate difference. We celebrated being the same as everyone else. So I wore that artificial arm until I finished high school. And it wasn't until I went to university that I decided that I felt more comfortable not wearing an artificial arm. And I think it was so that I was reflecting on that today when I was thinking about our conversation about when was it the time that I thought, no, I actually want to take control of how I look in the world. And it was when I went to university. And I'm now 53. I stopped wearing an artificial arm when I was 17. So I've definitely spent more of my life without it. Which is, yeah, it's something, yeah, it's a funny thing when you think about it. But I didn't think about it much at the time. I just kind of did it.
So that was an easy thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It just felt more authentic not to wear something that didn't look real. And for those of your listeners that know what artificial arms looked like, in the old days, they weren't very realistic. They were very ugly. They were very functional. Yeah. And I decided I'd rather cope without that added functionality. I'd rather improvise and find other ways to do things. And I that's more or less what I've done. Not always successfully. There are still times when I can't do things the way I would like. I do get frustrated at myself, and I still struggle to ask for help.
Yeah.
So as recently as doing some travel by myself a few months ago, wearing my hiking boots, walking around London, I can't tie my shoelaces up very tightly. I could not bring myself to ask a stranger to help me. Now, I'm quite confident, but I still struggle with that.
Where does that come from, Emma? Because I think many of us experience disability, even very different. You know, for me, juvenile chronic arthritis or Still's disease, one of the rheumatoid, very, very different experiences. Mm. And yet there's a golden thread that runs through our ability or sometimes reticence in asking in lifetime upfront. So where does that come from? What have you learned from those childhood experiences that you do differently now?
I think I'd ask for help. I think, and even though I had an example of quite recently where I didn't, I have to remind myself it's not weakness to ask for help.
Yeah.
Because I think we inherently think, I think I've inherently thought that if you ask for help, it highlights your difference more.
Yeah.
Because who wants to help a 53-year-old woman doing up her shoes? There's a little bit of embarrassment. There's perhaps shame in that. And I think that is definitely sometimes in the work setting. You want to be the same as everyone else. You don't want to stand out. You want to be noticed for your knowledge, for your functional skill, not for your difference of trying to do something. So you'll try to do it yourself, and you'll improvise, and you'll not make a big deal about it. You'll be quiet. Yeah. And I think that's what I would do differently. And I have to still remind myself to this day. Yep. It's hard, though, because you do have that soundtrack and you internalise those words into yourself.
Yep. Do you have words to tell yourself to jolt yourself out of that?
I don't have words, but I get impatient. And I think it's I'll just say, this is ridiculous. Just go and ask for help. No one is going to think less of you. And I just have to have that little, I just have to talk to myself and do it. It might be, for me, putting jewellery on, or if I'm home by myself, opening a jar in a certain way. Yeah. when I used to travel for work, making sure I had luggage I could manage by myself and not having to depend on anyone else. So that desire for independence is very strong for me. And so I like to do things myself.
Do you know, you trigger a memory years and years ago when I was chief executive of an NGO. You can see I love jewellery. And I had to go to a really big dinner in the evening. And I was wearing my PA, my personal assistant, had put on a really fancy, beautiful necklace. But the clasp was really difficult and I couldn't do it myself. And I forgot to ask a colleague to take my necklace off as I left this swanky building. I don't know, it was midnight and it was carriages, and I got home and I could take everything else off other than this necklace. So I went to sleep with the necklace and woke up the next morning, got into work. And there was I. And I remember, because there's one personal assistant I would ask to do these things. But the majority of my colleagues, of course, I wouldn't ask. And she wasn't there that day. It was a very late night and she had the day off. And I remember asking another colleague, but because what you're triggering is that when you have to steel yourself and you have to ask others who know you for maybe big deliveries or project management or, you know, to do a simple thing like take your necklace off, it's incredibly difficult.
Yeah, it almost feels sometimes, belittling's not the right word, but you feel smaller because you can't do this very basic task. And for me, walking around London, like, this is really, I just stuffed my shoelaces in the sides of my shoes. So I improvised.
Yeah.
And it was a silly thing to improvise, but because you just don't want to be reminded. I don't know. It's a tricky thing, but I will comfortably ask someone I know.
Yeah.
But I'm not very good at asking strangers. And I think that is, especially when you start work, and I can remember when I started work and I went to some lunch, you know, I would have been 22 or 23. It was a set menu and they served steak. I could not cut the steak up. And I thought, there is no way I'm going to ask my colleague next to me, because I'm like the junior of the junior sitting at the table. I just didn't eat it.
Yeah.
And no one, I'm sure, at that lunch remembers me not eating the steak. But it's a very vivid memory for me. Now I would ask the kitchen to slice it for me. But I didn't have that very simple tool. Because you don't want people to feel sorry for you. And sometimes when you have these little tasks that are very intimate in nature that you can't do, you feel like it puts you, it doesn't sit well with you and doesn't sit well with me. And I still struggle with some of those things every day.
Yep. Do you think there's ever a point that we transcend that, or do you think we're forever learning and we will exit this world still on that journey of learning how to deal with our stuff and other people's stuff and the interface between those two?
Oh, wow. I think it depends. That's such a complex question. It depends on, I think, creating the space that you are comfortable to be vulnerable in, because it's about vulnerability. Because asking someone to tie up it, to take off a necklace or put it on or do up your shoes or to cut up your meat at a work lunch or a work dinner, it's being vulnerable.
Yeah.
And I think if we create the spaces where people are comfortable being vulnerable, that's when it will change. And when you're with strangers, you don't feel like you can be vulnerable. I think that's the key. On the work side, it's great to see so many workplaces now recognising that vulnerability and belonging allow people to ask for help and just get on with whatever and not let those really small inconsequential things stop you from doing the job you're meant to be doing, whatever that is.
Yeah, I love it. So, Emma, let's move on. I mean, in my introduction, I gave our listeners, our audience, a sense of your really extraordinary career. You know, you have been the MD at Accenture. You started your career at Arthur Andersen. One of the themes in your job titles is general manager of really big operations. You clearly, you're stocking trade is getting things done. That's what you're known to do. You get things done. And I suppose my question, and I'd love the listeners to hear, you know, a sense of your career, but is there any aspect of your life as navigating your life as someone slightly different that in your view has contributed to your success in terms of being someone who gets things done?
Look, I don't actually, I think I am a doer. Yeah, yep. You want something done, I will organise it. I'm the logistics general manager in our family. So I am the doer. I am probably, my weakness is probably more strategic. But I don't think having a disability has given me an advantage or disadvantage in that core skill. I have a determination and I'm driven.
Yeah.
I'm not a perfectionist. I do understand that good, I shouldn't let perfection stand in the way of good. Sometimes good's good enough. But I like a list and I work through it. I don't think that having one hand has helped or hindered that. I think it's inherent to my personality that I'm a driver and I'm a doer. I'm determined. I will try very hard to do things, and I can be very, gently forceful in a work situation, if that's the right way to describe it. Yep. So maybe the determination part of it, and trying to find solutions to hard problems. That I think I have honed that skill by having one hand.
Yeah.
And if you've ever tried to put a nappy on a toddler, I challenge you to do it with one hand. My children are now 21 and almost 19, but that is bloody difficult. So, I can be quite determined and focused, and I do recognise there's always more than one way to do something. So I think that has been, I think the gift of my disability has been that problem-solving skill. The getting stuff done, I think I would have done regardless. I feel like that is inherent to who I am.
Yeah.
It's hard to know because you're born a certain way, so it's hard to know if you didn't have it or had it, it would be different.
I think it's really common, Emma. I mean, as you know, we work with and talk to and converse with many thousands of people with disabilities, disabled employees across many, many organisations, large and small, business, global multinationals, small private, small public, etc. And there is a theme that comes through in that on the one hand, we do have our default personalities and inherent skills, and if there's something about us, we continue to try and hone and develop them. But equally, there is something about the experience of disability that we didn't proactively invite into our life, yet nonetheless have had to find a way of sifting for gold. You know, what can I learn from myself? What do I learn from others at work?
Yeah. I think being an advocate for yourself is quite a skill that we learn quite early on.
Yeah.
And whether it's saying, I can't do this or I can do this, I need to do it in a different way, or I don't need a medical certificate to prove I have one hand, because that's certainly been something that has been asked of me in the past. And having those conversations gives you a certain level of persistence that absolutely can be great in a work situation, particularly in the project work that I've done in my career, where things can get tough, it's complicated, lots of different stakeholders. You know, being able to navigate complex situations and look for different solutions to problems is absolutely a skill that I can thank from my disability that has worked for me in my career.
I get you. What have you learned in terms of other people's reactions? You know, we've all, you have an incredible career that goes back years in the business community, in professional services firms. And, you know, there are typologies, there are occupational psychologies with different industries, whether you're in construction or engineering or, but what have you learned about how, and I know it's a generic question, so play with me here, Emma, but in terms of some of the reactions of others, what have you learned and what has that done to improve either your reactions or your behaviours or the things that you do different in the light of other people's stuff?
I think when I was younger, I definitely got teased, and I was definitely, I had things said about me in earshot, like, this is what happens if you don't eat your vegetables. You know, in a McDonald's, I know the look on your face was probably, I can't even tell you the look on my mother's face when she heard that. You know, children can be quite curious, and as an adult, I've always encouraged that curiosity. You know, you're curious because it's different. Come and ask me. Come and feel my arm. So the next time they see someone, it just tries to normalise it. In my experience, in a work situation, there's two types of people. There's the people that will ask you about what happened to your hand within the first 5 seconds of knowing you. And then there's the people that don't say anything. And which always fascinates me, because I'm like, well, you can see it. It's pretty obvious. And so I'll usually broach the subject. I'm very good at making a joke. I try to make people comfortable. So I take the role of, my job is to try to make other people feel comfortable with it. Yeah. I try to react well to curiosity. And as I've got older, I've always met that person halfway, because we don't know everything. We're not born with knowledge. There's lots of things I don't know. So people often will say things not unintentionally hurtful, unintentionally kind. It's just that they don't think. And in my experience, when you have that conversation, they go, I didn't realise, they'll walk away with a new piece of knowledge. I've never had a negative in a professional situation. I've never had a negative reaction. I've always consciously thought of what I'm carrying, how do I shake hands? So yeah. I've thought about my handbag, I've thought about where my laptop is, but no one's ever asked me about that. I've just naturally accommodated. And I think of all the clients I've worked with, they've always been wonderful, and many of them have become friends. And I think we are so much more than our disabilities, and that many people that know me for a long time will often say, we forget you've got one hand, which sounds weird, but I forget as well. So it becomes a non-issue. So it's just an issue often with people that just meet you, or if you're out in public, young children staring, and the parents are very embarrassed. And I often try to meet that child in a way that try to demystify it if it's appropriate. Because I'd rather have the questions. I was my son's show and tell at kinder, and I got some cracking questions. Because there's nothing like a bunch of four-year-olds to get to the gist of, how do you iron clothes, and how do you put necklaces on, and do you wear the same clothes every day, and how do you cut things up? So really practical questions. So you answer them very honestly. And that's how I've always approached things. I've always encouraged questions. And then so we can just move on, so we can put it away, and then we don't have to think about it again.
I'm curious that sometimes that takes a level of patience that other, you know, we know it for ourselves. Sometimes if we catch ourselves on a bad day, and we have to exercise patience and understanding and almost educating other, you must have an abundance of patience. How do you feel about that?
I think my family disagree, because I'm not very patient. I think it's more that I have no choice.
Yeah.
I mean, what am I going to do? Am I going to sit and cry in the corner about it? It's not going to grow back. I honestly can't imagine my life with two hands. I didn't think of myself as disabled for a long time, because I thought I can do most things. There's some things that are more annoying, but it's not, I've been able to navigate around it. I didn't lose it. I haven't acquired a disability. And I think that's a very, we all have a different perspective on this, but that this is my very personal perspective. So I don't know if I'm patient, but I just kind of think I have no choice. I have to, it's like wearing glasses or having blonde hair or being a certain height. It is what it is. There are some days where I feel ripped off, and there are some days that I certainly wish I had two hands, but they're not very often. It's not very often. It's often when I've gone shopping and I've got lots of things to carry, or I've, you know, it's something practical that I perhaps have faced that I hadn't considered before. But what's the alternative?
Yeah. Do you know, my family know me for saying it is what it is. It's one of my most used expressions. Yeah. And it's not about displaying a fatalistic mindset.
No.
It's about choose or knowing the difference between those things that you can input and influence and those things that you have absolutely no control over. And knowing the difference between those two, I think, is important.
Yeah, and as I've got older, I think you mentioned earlier in the conversation about not accepting how other people perceive you. And I think that's something that we can change. They are conversations we can have. Often people's perceptions of what you can and can't do come from a place of care. They don't come from a place of malice. They come from a place where people are worried. They don't want you to go into a situation perhaps that you are going to fail. It's absolutely okay to fail, and we should fail more often, because failure is a recipe for success. So I have failed a lot in my career, and I've succeeded a lot, but it hasn't all been. I've had really hard days. I've worked hard. I've had a little bit of luck, but I've failed more than I've succeeded. And I think that's a good sort of, and I'm sure I will continue to fail.
Yeah. Get you.
Yeah.
Most recently, you've gone on to found 20%.
Yeah.
Yeah. A consultancy that's advising, serving employers who want to do differently and better, you know, build a better, more accessible working world for employees with disability. Tell us why. What's your mission? What's your objective? What are you looking to contribute?
The why started when I worked at Accenture, and I was the exec sponsor for disability inclusion in ANZ, and I loved it, Kate. I loved my job, and why I loved it was that every time we spoke about disability, it was like this contagion, more people would come out of the woodwork. And I loved the conversations I had, and I wanted to do it full time. And I am at the right time in my career to step off a big corporate career. I want to have a bigger impact, and I want to help. I feel like that we've got so much work to do in this space that, and there's enough work for everyone, that we need all hands on deck. We need to encourage those conversations. We need to work with organisations that want to, my vision is to unlock the superpower of disability, and unlock that potential, whether it's in the communities companies work in, whether it's in their employees, from the board right down to the most junior employee. Like you, I'm a big believer in storytelling. And what I have seen and experienced is the more I've shared my story, I've had this contagion effect. I want to give the power of storytelling to other people. And I think that if you start to create that space, that's when great things start to happen. I know in my career, I always thought I was the only person with a disability. I never saw anyone like me. I never saw anyone. I never came across anyone. I thought, well, I'm the only person experiencing this. And that's not true. And once you start talking about it, I've just been amazed by all these little stories that have come out. And we're much more powerful together. So that's why I want to make a contribution. I'm a board member on a number of fantastic organisations. I want disability to be visible in senior leadership roles. If we are 20% of the population, where the hell are we? Why aren't we more visible in governments, in boards, in middle management, in graduate recruitment, at universities? We are there. And I think that's what I want to open. I want to help push that door wide open.
Do you know, Emma, my theory is, I mean, we do know that you've got to look long and hard to find stories and examples of people in senior leadership positions with a disability. We know that fact. We just know that fact. And yet, my hypothesis is that there are a good number out there who choose, for whatever reason, not to share that. And we know some of those reasons. But what would you say to your contemporaries, your senior contemporaries, who may sit as non-executive directors on you know, private companies or NGOs or public sector? What would you say to them about the gifts, the benefits of being much more open and visible and more authentic with our lived experience?
We can't be what we can't see. We can't encourage others to be in senior roles if we can't show the examples of it actually happening. Yep. I know if we are a fifth of the population, more or less, we are there in those ranks. Those stories are there. We need to create the spaces, even in the board table, that are safe for people to share their stories. I think there's fear. I think there's reluctance. There's people that go, but my story won't make a difference. Every single story makes a difference, because there might be one person that hears your story, that goes, well, I never knew I could be a board director if. And that's how we're going to change this, one story at a time. If we are at the decisions where, if we're at the tables where decisions are made, we're going to create a much more accessible and inclusive world just by being there, because we think differently. We think about how products are offered, how supermarkets operate, how banks operate, whatever the context, the industry is, disability needs to be served by all those industries. And at the currently, it's not. So I am deeply passionate about it, and I'm deeply driven to you know, how I can, in my small way, make a difference. But you know, the more that we can shout it from the rooftops, it will become this contagion effect. And we've got great examples of other diversity and inclusion pillars that have been before us, and we've seen the power of storytelling and the doors that have opened. And I can see the disability door is opening, but we need to kick it a lot harder.
I love it. Well, look, we wish you much luck with 20%. You know, for any listener, you know, take a look at Emma's website and have a look at some of the things that she is doing. Really extraordinary. Emma, I want to move on to some of the work that we're doing. So one of our strategic pillars is to build a suite of resources. And that's what today's, you know, podcast and this series of podcasts and films is all about, is to offer up stories of remarkable individuals who have built their confidence, their courage, their resilience over time. And we too are building those resources for our members. Our Confident Conversation series is just the starter pack. We talk about the six fundamentals and the six hurdles. There are many more on both sides. I know you've read some of those. And I suppose my question is, which of those fundamentals has meaning for you? You know, what would you expand upon? And then which of the hurdles too spoke to you? And if you could pull one of both of those.
They're all great and they all resonate with me. I think the fundamentals, the one that stood out, which was spoken about briefly, is connecting with others. I recently met someone in a professional service firm who has exactly the same arm as me. Now, we're 20 years different in age, but the conversation we had was so powerful because you have someone that can relate to you, you can relate to, and they can relate to you. I felt like I'd made a best friend. Now, I wish I had known this person or a person like this person when I had my when I started my career, and I could say, is there a better mouse to use? Is there a lighter laptop to use? How do you type with one hand? You know, let's have a just, and we had a long discussion about how you learn to type with one hand. Now, you can look at a lot of things on the internet, but having that one-on-one conversation, I think, is really powerful. If you, so join the network. If you don't have a network in your organization, start one. Because just sharing those shared experiences and having that place to say, this was a really hard experience for me. What did you think, or what would you do, is really, and it's not about levels within the organization. It almost is a, it's a very flat discussion. It doesn't matter if you're more junior or you're more senior. It's really powerful. And in some of the clients that I've worked with, I've seen the power of storytelling and having people within the organization just share their own stories, and people go, well, I never realized. So connecting with others, I think, is something that definitely resonates with me. On the limitations, I think there's one about self-belief and limiting self-belief. We all have these voices in our heads, and they're often voices that have been honed after many years of other what other people have told you. For me, it was that I couldn't do freestyle. I could not swim properly. I thought until about 10 years ago, you needed to have two arms to do freestyle. I went to a swimming coach. He said, no, you swim from your core. Your arms have got nothing to do with it. But I had this soundtrack in my head that I couldn't do it. Now, I'm not a great swimmer. I'm a slow swimmer, but I can swim. And I felt really proud of myself that I actually decided to ignore that voice, but it took me 40 years to ignore that voice. And so I think that we all have these things that we have convinced ourselves that we can't do, or we do in a different way. And I think it's sometimes it's good to challenge them. I still have self, you know, I still think there's things I can't do. We all have that imposter syndrome. So it's not like I don't want people to think that I'm super confident, because I still worry about things and I still have things that I find difficult. But it's a good reminder that often our biggest limitation is us, can be ourselves.
Oh, it's so powerful.
Mm.
It's so powerful, Emma. You know, when I first set up Purple Space 2015, this was a decade after working as a consultant,
yep,
in my own business, helping businesses to set up networks. And it wouldn't be uncommon to talk to and work with a DEI lead who would perhaps suggest that people with disabilities have nothing common, either with each other with the same impairment or disability, or with different. And I remember thinking, that can't be so, because it is often the little stories, talking to others who have experienced something profoundly similar, that breaks down that loneliness and challenges us to think differently and deeper about, as you say, these self-limiting behaviours. So it's very powerful, connecting, networking.
Yeah, I think it is. It is. It just gives you that, oh, someone else had that experience. And I think that gives you, because sometimes you do think it's just you and you don't want to raise it because you don't want to be the voice of the person that raises it. I was at a work function years ago, and the activity was juggling. And there was maybe, I don't know, 500 people in the room. Now, I obviously can't juggle. So do you want to be the person in the room of 500 people that says, this is a really terrible activity, I can't do it?
Yeah.
I just walked out. I just left. Because I didn't want to spoil everyone else's fun.
I totally get that.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. Now, again, was not set up with any malice or intent to, but they just hadn't thought that perhaps a one-handed person would find juggling difficult. It just hadn't even crossed, and this is probably 7 or 8 years ago. So I'm sure those activities would be much more well considered now.
Do you know, you trigger a question. What would you do? I mean, now, would you offer feedback, or do you think I enough already? You know, I'm not on this planet to educate every single
Well,
rubbish
a
moment.
similar situation has happened to me in the last year where I had a situation where I had to ride an electric bike. Now, I can ride a bike, but because of where an electric bike is, the battery, the balance is a bit off. And I frankly thought, I've tried it. I don't want to learn for this in front of a group of a whole lot of people I don't know. It was a client function. So I stepped out of it. I took my own bike. I had to ride 20 kilometres the old way instead of the easy way. But I used it as an example in the talk I gave after lunch. So the difference was I still couldn't do it, but I had the courage to tell them about it. That's what I would do differently. Because people are going to make mistakes. This is not a perfect science, right? And we don't have all the answers. There are so many different disabilities. We all have different experiences. Yeah, some things are going to work for some people and some things aren't going to work. Yeah, it's not always going to be 100% for everyone. So we have to recognize that. And we have to be able to have the conversation in a way that's not perhaps angry or in a way that invites a good result. So that would be my approach now. 10 years ago, I was just annoyed. I was annoyed and upset. But I didn't have the courage to go and do anything. I didn't know what to do. There was no such thing as a network. I didn't know what to do, or an exec sponsor. So now I would try to create change out of that. Say, well, maybe let's think about this differently.
Got you. Got you. Well, look, penultimate question, Emma. So we learn as much about ourselves, you know, when living with disability, and our, I suppose, our key drivers, the things that we think about, why we're on this planet, what we want to do as humans, as citizens, and self-limiting behaviors, etc. You know, so we learn as we go along about what we want to do, what stops us internally. And the longer we live with disability, I think the more profound those learns are. You know, they say you make sense of life by looking backwards, but of course we have to live it, living forward. As you look back, so you look back at that young Emma. You know, she might be in the playground, she might be hanging out with her mum or her friends at school. So as you look back at young Emma, even before she set out on her career, or as she was setting out on her career, what would you warn her against? Or what would you encourage her to hear in terms of the joy that these experiences have brought to your life? You know, but challenge and joy. What would you say to her?
I would say I'd probably warn her against thinking that disability is a bad word, because I think for a long time I thought that. And I always used to think if I was ever in the Olympics, which would ne was never going to happen, let's be honest, I would be in my mind in the normal Olympics because I wasn't disabled. And I think I would challenge that young person to say it's not a bad word. When I started work, disability wasn't mentioned at work. In fact, it wasn't properly mentioned until 5 or 6 years ago. So no one asked me about it. No one offered help. So I would also ask for help earlier. And I would try to advocate for change earlier. I wish I had known the word of networkology or networks when I was a 21-year-old. I wish we had learned about it at university in a business degree. I wish I had valued my difference differently. Now, and maybe this is an age thing too, as a 53-year-old, I love being different. I love using it to my absolute advantage. People remember me. Someone in Dubai Airport offered me help going through the security. I said, fantastic. I took it. I don't see it as a weakness, as I did when I was younger. You don't have to do it alone. So I think that's what I would, there's not much I would change. I feel like I feel pretty blessed to have had quite a fantastic career and it's not over yet. I feel like I'm just starting again. But I think that's how I thought about myself. I think my desire to be like everyone else, I would not encourage.
Got you.
Yeah.
Bound. I love it. Look, our next and last question actually builds on this theme, Emma. As you know, it's tradition in many podcast series to build in the closing tradition of asking the previous guest to ask the next guest a question, in this case, about the role and the value of building inner confidence. So the question that our last guest asked for you is, if you had a time machine and you could go back to the start of your career, so there you are filling out the CV or the application form for Arthur Anderson, what have you, so and fix one single mistake. I mean, bear with me here, but what would you fix, or what is there like a not so brilliant move that you made in terms of building your brand as a woman, a doer? And what would that be? What would you fix?
I think I wouldn't assume that other people will notice my hard work. I think that would be the mistake. If I could go back in time to 21-year-old Emma, who was just starting out in her career, I honestly thought if you worked hard, you'd just be promoted and it would all just happen. And guess what? No, it doesn't. You've actually got to go and tell people about the work you do, and you've got to be strategic, and you've got to do what everyone else is doing around you. I think that's what I would do. I think for a long time I waited to be noticed. And I thought if you and I, you obviously have to work hard. You have to do that's the minimum. And I think that's what I would change. I've always been very good at saying yes to, I've always said yes to opportunities. So I wouldn't change that. I haven't been scared at trying new things, so I wouldn't change that. But yeah, I think I would just not trust the process as much to work hard, be promoted, because in my experience, that didn't happen. I had to take agency of my career, and that's when it went in the direction I wanted. I would do that earlier. I would own my career earlier.
You know, on the one hand, it's a universal truth and learn. And on the other hand, there's something of your experience too, which adds a little piquancy, a little purple piquancy about the necessity to do just that.
Yeah, I mean, the things that I wouldn't change is I continue to work after I had kids, and I'm very happy with that decision. And my kids are no less normal for having been childcare and all that sort of stuff. So I wouldn't change any of that. But yeah, it is probably just to be more confident in my own ability to go and advocate for myself. And to think of all the things we've spoken about today, I wish my voice, my advocacy voice, existed in my 20s and my 30s.
Yeah.
I undervalued my own lived experience. I haven't valued my lived experience until the last 10 years. And
Interesting.
what a waste. What a missed opportunity that was. I should have valued it more. And I think if I valued it more, other people would have valued it. Because if we don't value ourselves, we can't expect other people to value ourselves. So I think that's what I would would also reconsider Wiser. Yeah. And buy Microsoft shares and Apple shares, all those sort of things, if you could go back in time. and tell the nun that told me that I shouldn't get a job in, that involved typing in 1985, that she was wrong and that one-handed people can type. So that's what I wish I could go back and have the courage to say, not accept it, and have the courage to have that conversation and to educate that person. I never had that confidence to do that.
Emma, really, really powerful. Well, look, in the moral of the story is you just can't retire ever because there's work to be done.
That's true. There is lots of work to be done. And that's why those stories need to be shared.
Wonderful. Emma, I have so enjoyed our time together. As I say, the last time we saw each other, we had a lovely evening. And this, you know, we're thinking about this and planning for this, and you have, you know, offered such profound truths about the things that you have learned, so which have broad application, you know, wherever one is on the spectrum, or when one has been diagnosed, or whether one has been born with an aspect of difference, etc., etc. So these learns, you know, are super they're like a muscle. They'll work in very many directions for very many people. So thank you. So look, our tradition is that we ask you to write a question to our next interviewee. So I wonder if you just spend a little minute having a think and perhaps write that question, and we'll pass it on to the next interview. No. So for the moment, I thank you on behalf of all of our listeners for your time and your courage. And yes, never retire. You heard it here first.
Thanks, Kate. It was a pleasure.
Purple Space is on a mission to cascade a universal definition of inner confidence for employees with disabilities. Our organisation members can access a growing suite of learning tools in order to navigate our working worlds while managing disability, deafness, mental health and neurodivergence. Notice the fundamentals. Remember the hurdles. Take individual action. For more information, visit our website www.purplespace.org. Purple Space is on a mission to cascade a universal definition of inner confidence for employees with disabilities. Our organisation members can access a growing suite of learning tools in order to navigate our working worlds while managing disability, deafness, mental health and neuro-